Thank you. Hello. Can you guys hear me? Cool. Excellent. That's a good start. The mic works. So did anyone ever ask, why did the keynote actually have stuff to do with Scala at a Java conference? Or was I the only one who thought that? Anyway, my name is Manik Sirtani. I'm the lead on JBoss Cash. I work for Red Hat. I'm a core contributor to a lot of other JBoss projects as well. And I'm going to talk about, firstly, JBoss Cash and clustering enterprise Java for scalability and high availability, as that says. Lots of big words there, but it's not as complicated as it sounds. So what I'm going to talk about specifically, I'm going to talk about data grids, why data grids are important today, why clustering is important in Java today, and how you actually do this to cope with a lot of load. If you need to scale a system out, how do you actually do that? Now, I'm going to talk about this in a very abstract sense. I'm not going to talk about JBoss Cache specifically, at least not in the beginning. And after I do that, I'm then going to go into the specifics of JBoss Cache and how we do this in JBoss Cache specifically. I was actually going to have a little live demo there, a very, very scary live demo in front of, 400 people, right? And you know how live demos work? Well, they don't. I actually removed the live demo because of time constraints. Yeah. I'm going to talk about strategies. Now, these strategies are actually very interesting. This is what I like about open source. I mean, I'm an open source developer, and I like open source because there's a huge network effect when you have the community that develops stuff with you, that provides feedback. It's one of those things. We come up with stuff, and people figure out what to do with them. So this whole section in strategies is how other people have used JBoss Cache in very clever and innovative ways to achieve some pretty remarkable things. And I'm going to talk about some of the better ones that we've seen. The last section on benchmarks, I kind of just stuck that in as well, because we're on the cusp of a major new release, and we've been doing a lot of this stuff in the last couple of months, so I thought I'd share this with you as well. So moving swiftly on, I'm going to start with some definitions. Now, the reason why I've got this section here is because I've done this talk so many times, and at the end of it, everyone's got a different opinion of what a cache is and what a cluster is and so on and so forth, and everyone wants to have an argument about it. They're like, no, that's not a cluster. A cluster is when you have two CPUs in one server. That's a cluster. That's not a cluster. Well, for a hardware guy, maybe that is. But I just decided up front, I'm going to start with some definitions. Now, these definitions don't come from anywhere other than my head. This is not from Wikipedia. It's not from some university. No. So what I call a cache, when I talk about cache throughout this presentation, what I mean is a temporary data store, right? It's something that's in memory. It's a data structure that's in memory that's very cheap to access. It's very fast to access, right? It's got to be highly concurrent. It's got to be thread safe. Otherwise, it's not a cache, right? And you typically use it to store stuff that's either expensive or difficult to retrieve. Now, stuff from a database, for example, it's expensive to connect to a database and retrieve it. You want to cache it nearby if you use it frequently. Or it could be a complex calculation that you do that uses a lot of CPU cycles. You want to cache that stuff too. The whole section on enterprise features, I mean, some caches do these things, some caches don't. What I call enterprise features are things like transactions, things like event listeners. These are all extras, and we'll talk about those in detail as well. Now, when I talk about a cluster, I talk about, like the slide says, a collection of homogeneous services. Now, what does this mean? This means a software service. It's not a hardware thing. A cluster is not a hardware thing in my mind. In my head, a cluster is a software thing. It's a service that's replicated. It's a clone. There are lots of clones of these things everywhere. And they all do exactly the same thing. They exhibit the same characteristics. Each instance in a cluster does the same thing as the next instance. They're all clones. Now, why is this good? This is good because you can now have failover. If one of them stops working for whatever reason, the server crashes, I don't know, you've got some silly network admin who trips over an Ethernet cable, bang, there goes your server, right? Yeah, that does happen, okay? It sounds funny, but actually does happen. You've got a replica of this service somewhere else. Now, you can also use clusters to balance load. If you've got a requirement where you've got a lot of transactions happening, a lot of stuff happening, and you need to cope with load, one instance is not enough. If you have replicas, if you have identical copies of this stuff, they can all share the load. They can split the number of transactions they do, right? So you can scale outwards that way. Cluster instances don't necessarily have to be on different servers. They don't even have to be in different VMs. They could be all in the same JVM. They could be in different JVMs. They could be in different physical machines, right? When they're in different JVMs, typically they communicate using sockets, using some sort of a network protocol. Now, what's a distributed, a clustered cache, firstly? So I talked about a cache, I talked about a cluster. I put those two things together, right? And this is what a clustered cache is. It's basically a cache that is clustered. It's a replica of a cache. It's the same service available many times over in a cluster. So everyone sees the same thing. Everyone sees the same data. And everyone has very fast access to that same data. Perfect if you want to build a highly scalable system. If suddenly you need to cope with more load, you throw another server in, it'll get another copy of this cache. It's got all the same stuff in memory. Great, right? Now, a distributed cache becomes much more interesting. A clustered cache is good. It is useful. It's handy. But it's got a couple of pretty severe scalability limitations. Limitations meaning that you need to synchronize all these copies, right? You've got so many replicas everywhere. They've all got to be the same. And there's a lot of work that goes around to make sure everything is the same and they're not out of sync. A distributed cache is more interesting because you don't actually mirror state across the cluster. Most likely, if you've got an application that's clustered, they don't all need exactly the same data. They need a different subset of the data. So a distributed cache will move subsets of data around. It'll fragment your data that you put in the cache, and it'll spread these different fragments around the cluster transparently. You don't know about it. You don't need to know about it. You don't know where it is. All you know is you've got a cluster. You've got a big cluster with lots of servers, and you put something in there. You know that there are enough copies that if some servers die, you've not lost anything, right? But you've also not sucked up all the memory in this entire cluster by copying everything everywhere, and you don't have a huge scalability bottleneck where you're, synchronizing with everyone. Each instance is trying to talk to another instance, and so on and so forth. Distributed caches are fairly complex in that you've got some pretty interesting algorithms to try and locate where your data is. If you ask an instance, I need to get this key, it needs to find it in this cluster and give it back to you. So let's take a step back now. We're done with the definitions. Why do people actually need to cache stuff? Well, why is a cache so important? So I mentioned, sometimes things are expensive to retrieve, right? Or expensive to calculate. And that actually helps you a lot. Now, on a very simple level, a cache is basically a hash map, right? A hash map is a cache. So you put stuff in there, you can get it back very quickly. But a hash map is not enough. It's not enough because it does not do things like data validity. You need to make sure the stuff that you've cached is still valid. Your application can come back 5 minutes later and try and look in the cache and get this stuff back out. And it could be stale. How do you know? Right. So a cache needs to do this stuff. It needs to make sure the data you have in the cache is valid. It's not stale. It's not out of date. If it's out of date, you need to throw it away and get it again. It needs to do that. If you're talking about a clustered cache or a distributed cache, cluster-wide coherence is a big problem as well. You need to make sure everything is in sync. You shouldn't have one instance that says the state of a particular variable is X and another instance that says the state of variable X is of this variable is something else. I mean, you've got a problem if that happens. So coherence is very important, and keeping everything in sync is important. But this is actually pretty expensive. And this is why I mentioned overcaching. Overcaching is actually a big problem. I've done a lot of consultancy engagements with customers who need help making things faster, usually. That's always the thing, Let's call some really expensive consultant. I'm sure he can make things faster. No one else can. Some of the simplest solutions are actually what works. I mean, I've seen so many systems where people have so many caches, layers upon layers. Let's try and cache this. Let's try and cache that. And that makes things so complex and so brittle. I make things faster by removing these caches. people don't realize caches are everywhere. There's a cache in your hard disk. Chances are your JDBC driver's got a built-in cache. Your app server's got a couple of caches somewhere in there. And then you want to stick one in your application as well. And what's the point? Well, this is why I've got that quote up there. I mean, measure, don't guess. You should never, ever design your application to have a cache in it. If you've done that, you've done something wrong. That's from the outset, right? If you've got your application design and you've got a cache in there, you've done something wrong. You only put a cache in later. A cache is one of the last steps in the process. You've already built your application. You've tested it. It works. You apply some load. You realize that there are bottlenecks. Aha, okay, now there are bottlenecks. How do I remove these? That's when you put a cache in, right? So make sure there's a bottleneck first before you actually put a cache in. Very important, very important. So why do people build clusters now? Again, depending on the application you're building, some applications need certain service level agreements. They need to be up 24/7. They should never, ever go down, whether it's a telecom system or things like that. It's also a case of expectations. I mean, today a lot of people tend to build websites, and they've got very high expectations from their systems. They expect everyone in the world to be using it all the time. So it should never go down. I mean, yeah, sometimes it's true, sometimes it's not. But very often customers say this is the way they want it. So hence you need a cluster. You need to have high availability. You need to be able to upgrade the stuff without actually having the site go down. You need to be able to do maintenance. You need to be able to update versions of software without things going down. And if things do go down for whatever other reason, I mean, like I said, the old network admin tripping over the Ethernet cable, that should not stop your website from running. And then there are spikes. Amazon over Christmas deals with 10 times the load it deals with at any other time, because over Christmas, everyone wants to go to Amazon and buy Christmas presents, right? So it needs to have that kind of high availability. Now, coherence is kind of interesting in the cluster. Coherence is very expensive, and this is not a joke about Oracle's product in favor of an open source one. What I'm referring to is the cost of keeping caches synchronized in a cluster. It's very expensive, okay? It becomes even more expensive as the cluster gets bigger and bigger and bigger. The bigger it gets, the more expensive it gets. Now, sometimes you don't always need to keep things in sync as much. Now, if you want to keep things perfectly in sync, in perfect coherence, you need to use synchronized replication so that every time you copy anything to anyone else, you get an acknowledgement back saying, yes, I received it, and yes, everyone else received it, and yes, everyone's got the same state. That's the perfect world. Now, very theoretical, very nice, right? Practically, not very scalable. It works for a smallish cluster. The moment you try and throw in, you know, more and more servers, 10, 12, 15 servers, no, it starts becoming a problem. So you need to decide, again, in your application, how important is this coherence? How much discrepancy can you tolerate? Can you use an asynchronous model? Does that work? It might work for some systems. For example, if you actually have a website and you want to use asynchronous replication scales much, much better than synchronous replication. The reason being, if you want to copy state to everyone else in the cluster and you want to do this asynchronously, you just put a message on the wire, a single multicast message, everyone gets it, everyone applies the state, but you don't care. You don't need to wait for everyone to tell you that they did it. So you just put the message and you go away and you continue doing your stuff. So much more scalable. It doesn't matter how big your cluster gets, you're still going to have the same response times. Much better, right? Now, based on your application, it may be okay if some people are slightly out of sync or get a message a little bit late. But that's very application-specific stuff. So from clustering, we move on to data grids. And data grids are getting very, very popular now. Now, my definition of a data grid is just a very big cluster, to be honest. That's really all it is. It's a very big cluster, potentially built using specific hardware like blades, using IP backplanes, things like that. So very fast networking kit, very cheap, very fast blades, right? Why are they getting more popular? Well, hardware is cheap. CPUs are cheap. Memory is cheap. It's getting cheaper and cheaper, right? It's also becoming easier to write grid software. You don't now need to think about complex scheduling algorithms and mechanisms to move state across a cluster and things like that. You've got frameworks to do that for you. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of grid gain. Has anyone ever heard of grid gain here? Any hands? No? No, a couple over there. So grid gain is actually a very, very interesting framework. It's open source as well. Basically, it allows you to write a runnable class which does some work, and you put that class into GridGain, and GridGain finds the optimal server to run it on. It does all the scheduling for you. As far as you're concerned, you're just running this runnable locally. You don't know that it's being run on a different server somewhere else. So it's a great way to build grid-enabled applications. It makes it very, very easy to do. On the hardware side of things, things like Amazon's EC2 make it very easy as well. You've got the hardware support, Elastic Clouds and things like that. Very cheap, very easy ways to deploy scalable applications. So as a result, what's happening is a lot of people are building grids, even for relatively simple applications. Why? Because they can, it's easy, and to be honest, it actually works a lot better than your traditional application model. Now, what's the impact of this? Data availability becomes much more important. You now need to have that data available all over this grid. Right? If your grid's going to grow and shrink in size dynamically based on your load, you need to have this your state available everywhere. And your data retrieval bottleneck. I spoke about this earlier when you've got a cluster and everyone's trying to go to the same database. That's expensive, right? Imagine how much more expensive it becomes in a grid. It becomes infinitely more expensive. If the grid's going to grow dynamically, you've still got that one database, that one poor guy trying to shell out connections. I mean, you've got a huge problem there. So this morning, Ted actually stole a bit of my thunder. I was actually going to make that whole Quake Law joke, and he actually beat me to it. I was going to say the same thing. I was going to talk about Moore's Law and Amdahl's Law and how Moore's Law is dead and Amdahl's Law is going to rule. And basically, Amdahl's Law, he didn't mention Amdahl's Law, so I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Does anyone know what Amdahl's Law is? Any hands? A few over there? Okay. So Amdahl's law basically is that, I'm not going to go to the detail of the actual law, but what it kind of states is that the efficiency you're going to gain out of distributed workloads is the granularity with which you can break down your work and the efficiency with which you can move this work around a cluster or a grid and pull back the results and collate these results. So it's a bit like Google's MapReduce style algorithms, things like that, and how efficient your mechanism is to do that. So in multi-core CPUs, as Ted mentioned this morning, this is the way hardware manufacturers are making things faster, right? But that doesn't really come for free. I mean, you got 2, 4, 6, whatever, multi-core CPUs, 768 CPUs on Azul systems. They're very cool machines, by the way. And no, they don't play, you can't play Quake on them. I've tried. You don't get the stuff for free. You can't just take your application and put it on a multi-core system and hope you're going to get all the benefits. No, you need to write your application to make use of it. Your application needs to be thread safe, very important. You have lots of concurrent hardware threads, CPU threads, working on shared state, not just software threads anymore, right? Now, you then take that and apply that to a grid. You're basically saying you've now got a grid of servers. Each server's multi-core. Each server's got, 8 cores or 16 cores or something like that. And your grid's got, 100 nodes in it. Jesus, that's a lot of threads. Now imagine all that hitting that database. That database is going to die. There's no other way to say it. I was, again, on a consultancy gig, and these guys had built a very, very impressive grid framework. It was about 1,000 nodes, 1,000 servers. Each one had 4 cores, so a lot of concurrent threads. And their plan was that this would, increase their response times by N or whatever it was, and things would happen very, very quickly. They forgot; they didn't realize that they had one little Oracle server in the back end with all the data. Needless to say, that project didn't go very far. Well, it didn't go very far in the way it was. What they did do is they actually did use a distributed cache in the end so that stuff from the database was actually cached in memory on each of these grid nodes and shared and distributed, and then it flew. That was fine. Basically, why is this so? Firstly, it's a hardware thing, right? the way memory works, memory is more parallel than disk. Memory can deal with far greater concurrent access than disk can. That's just the way the buses are, the interconnects are. I mean, IBM is sinking a lot of money into researching newer ways of talking to a hard disk, so they can achieve the same thing with memory. It'll be several years before that comes into play. And when I say several, I'm talking tens of years at least. You may think that solid-state disks are the answer. No, that's not true. Yeah, solid-state disk is fast to access because it's memory-based, but the interconnect is still a SCSI interconnect, and that's where the problem is. It's the bus that talks to the disk. So disks are inherently serial in nature. It does serialize calls down whenever you read or write from a disk, and that is the problem here. And this is why caches are important. This is why memory is important. This is where your state should be. That little quote over there is one of my favorite quotes, actually, from Tim Bray. I hate Tim Bray because he invented XML, but I don't mind him because of that quote. So how does all this wrap up into JBoss Cache? Well, firstly, JBoss Cache is a distributed cache. It's a clustered cache. It's also a local cache. It does all of what I was talking about and more. I mentioned that in its simplest form, a cache is just a map, right? It's just a hash map. But it actually needs to do more than that. It needs to be able to evict stuff. You don't want to run out of memory in your cache, right? If you're just using a hash map, you just keep putting stuff in. I'm reading stuff, putting it in the cache. You're going to run out of memory eventually, right? Your database inevitably is an order of magnitude bigger than the amount of memory you've got, right? So eviction is a very important feature of a cache. You need to have eviction. You need to be able to remove stuff, remove the least recently used items or the least frequently used or something. Cache loading and storing, again, very important. You need to be able to overflow stuff. If you're going to evict stuff from memory, you need to be able to overflow it onto disk, perhaps, or something. Also important if you want to have a warm cache, so as your machine starts up, it preloads everything into memory. This is very important for response times. I was helping out on this big telco project where they could not use a database because the response times were just too slow based on the number of users they had and the kind of response times they needed. They had to preload everything into the cache. The system took 20 minutes to start up, but that's fine. They didn't mind that. You only start it up, once in several months or whatever, right? But once it's started up, everything's in memory and it's fine. It flies afterwards. So cache loading, very important feature of a cache. JBoss Cache specifically also supports chaining caches. Chaining caches is very interesting. You can actually have some caches living in the VM space of your application and then others living outside of it where you can address a far greater memory space. I'm going to go into this in a lot more detail later. I've got some diagrams and stuff, and I'll explain it better then, so I'm just going to skim through it for now. JTA transactions, important again. Who here actually writes applications that don't use JTA? I see some hands. Right, let's hope it's not a banking application, okay? Otherwise, I'm not using your website. Listeners, notifications, JMX, useful things. You need to know what's happening in your cache, right? You need to be able to monitor it. Your application needs to be able to monitor it. Your sysadmin needs to be able to monitor it and tune it. Locking schemes. Locking schemes are very, very important for anything that's going to be thread safe. I'm going to spend a little bit of time here on this because this I think this is a pretty important area. Traditionally, Java's locking is very coarse and very ugly. It's called a synchronized keyword. And it basically gets a hold of a mutex, whether it's for reading or writing. It's a single lock. It's very expensive to acquire. And it's very, very coarse-grained, right? So not very good for a cache, not very scalable, not very performant. Things got a little bit better with Java 5, where you actually have a concept of a lock class with read locks and write locks, and read locks can be concurrent and write locks are exclusive and things like that. So you've got finer grained control and things did get better, but still not quite good enough, right? In JBoss Cache, we supported, originally it was just two different locking mechanisms, optimistic and pessimistic locking. Basically, let's start with the pessimistic lock, actually. As the name suggests, it's basically a scheme where before anybody reads or writes anything, they need to acquire a lock. Right? Very simple JDK 5 read lock or write lock. That's it. And that worked. It worked well. It was, you know, it was efficient enough. It provided guarantees. Data didn't get corrupted. It was fine. But it was not good enough. It was still too slow. Why was it too slow? It was too slow because every reader needed to get a read lock, and you know that was unnecessary, and you couldn't do concurrent writes and things like that. So that's when you came up with an optimistic scheme. The optimistic scheme was a little bit more interesting. You only get the lock as your thread comes in, and it makes a copy of the data. It makes a copy of any state it's going to touch, and then it releases the lock, which is great. So it holds the lock for a very, very short amount of time just to make a copy, and then for the lifespan of that transaction, it works on the copy. It means that there are fewer locks. Locks are held for a much shorter time, and so on and so forth. Much, much higher degree of concurrency, right? Many more concurrent threads could work on the same data. But there was another problem with optimistic locking. It's not very efficient. If every thread had to make a copy of things, I'll let you guys think about what the memory usage is going to be like, right? So lots of copies floating everywhere, not so good, right? So we came up with MVCC. This is very, very new stuff, and this is brilliant. MVCC stands for Multiversion Concurrency Control. It basically takes the best of optimistic locking and the best pessimistic locking and puts them together. It's what most major database vendors use to achieve concurrency within a database. And our particular implementation of MVCC is really interesting as well, because for readers are completely lock-free. A reading thread does not even have to acquire a read lock, which means it is absolutely lightning fast. And for a cache, which is essentially a read mostly data structure, it's brilliant. It works great. For writers fail fast. Writers know immediately if someone else is writing, so you know immediately, so on and so forth. The writers actually do a copy on write scheme, which is much more efficient than obtaining locks directly. We also have our own lock implementations for the writers. But yeah, that's all detail. Okay, flavors. JBoss Cache comes in a couple of flavors, right? There's a core edition. The core edition is very good. That's what you cache simple objects. Very simple, right? It's a cache. It's a data structure. You put stuff in. Pojo Cache is a bit more interesting. It's more interesting because if you have a big and complex object, right? Let's say an XML DOM tree. I don't know, 30 megabytes, right? Very, very big XML DOM tree. You want to put that in the cache. Cool, yeah, you can do that. But it means that every time you make a change to it, JBoss Cache needs to serialize it and replicate it. And that's expensive, okay? It's expensive. It takes a long time to serialize. Serialization really sucks in Java. It's slow. What sucks as well is network communications. You've now got 30 megabytes of state that you now need to push across a network. Depending on what your network's like, that can be slow. Right? So Pojo Cache makes all that a lot easier. What it actually does is it uses bytecode manipulation. So when you put your object in the cache, what Pojo Cache does is it breaks down your bytecode. It looks at your bytecode, it analyzes it, and then it only stores the primitives in the cache. Only primitives, that's it. And it monitors your object. So whenever you change things, it knows which fields have changed, and it's only those that get replicated. So you get very, very fine-grained replication, which is very efficient to serialize, very efficient to replicate, so on and so forth. Basically, now it sounds very cool and all of that, right? But it's not exactly a catch-all either. You should not use Pojo Cache for everything. It's got a cost to it, right? It's expensive to sit and, you know, manipulate your bytecode. It's expensive to sit and watch your objects for changes, right? So if your object is really complex, yes, use Pojo Cache. If it's not that complex, don't use it. It's unnecessarily expensive to do that stuff. You'll save a little bit in replication, but your CPU cycles are going to go up, and so on and so forth. A searchable cache, this is something very new. This came out of a Google Summer of Code project, actually. Thank you, Google. basically, it adds a listener to the cache, and every time you put anything in it, it generates Lucene indexes, so you can then write a query to find the stuff in the cache. Very fast, very efficient, You get all the coolness of all of the Lucene query structures, you know, like fuzzy queries, things like that. Very cool stuff, right? And basically, this is where we get very close to an in-memory distributed object database. You can actually run queries on it too now. So wrong keyboard. So a very quick summary. This is where it's used within JBoss. The app server uses it to cluster sessions, EJB sessions. Hibernate uses it, Seam uses it. I mean, it's a pretty well-used project. GridGain actually uses it as well. GridGain ships with JBoss cache to move data around. And there'll be several others coming soon as well. I don't know if anyone's actually used Drules. Drules is a rules engine, and this is actually very interesting because running a rules engine on a single node is interesting enough. Actually running it in the clusters is pretty interesting stuff. How would anyone else use it? How would you guys use it? Well, it's an LGPL library, so it's open source. It's free to use. It's a pretty small jar, not many dependencies. You don't need an app server. This is something that I've been stressing a lot. Everyone's got this preconception in their heads that, you know, if you want to use JBoss Cache, you need to use JBoss AS. No, not true. People use it on GlassFish and WebLogic and all sorts of other things. Some people don't use it with an app server at all, right? At this point, I was actually going to bring up a demo, but like I said, I'm going to skip it because there's really not a lot of time. Go to the website, download the GUI demo. Right? You're going to see my swing programming skills over there, and try not to laugh. All right. So I'm going to talk very briefly about some of those strategies now, those high availability strategies that I mentioned. This is stuff that's come out of the community, what people have been doing with JBoss Cache, and how they've achieved certain pretty cool things, right? Now, one of the things with JBoss Cache is that every time it starts up, in default mode anyway, it forms a cluster with its neighbors, it does a discovery phase, it finds who else is around it, and it asks its neighbors for state. It says, give me the stuff that you've got in memory. I need to have a copy too, right? So, very simple, out of the box it works, but that can be expensive. Now, let's say you've got, I don't know, a gigabyte's worth of state, right? Pretty possible, right? In each cache. So every time you start up a new one, it takes a while to serialize a gig and transfer it and apply that internally. So your startup time goes up. But that's not such a big deal. I mean, you know, you're bringing up a new system. Yeah, it can take a bit of time. The bigger problem is on the sender. The sender slows down as well because the guy who's providing you the state, he's wasting CPU cycles serializing a gig just to send it to you. And chances are you're never going to use that anyway because you need other stuff. So this strategy over here, using a lazy state transfer, involves actually switching off your state transfer. You start up your system saying, no, I don't want any state from anybody. But instead of using a normal cache loader, we wrote something called a clustered cache loader. This was actually contributed by somebody, and we actually ended up rolling it into the distribution because it was so useful. It's basically a cache loader that does not load stuff from disk, but it loads stuff from its neighbors, as in when you need it. It loads stuff on the fly. So if you go to the cache and say, give me key X, and it realizes it doesn't have it, it'll ask its neighbors then and there for it. So they pull it down lazily and bring back your state lazily, basically. This is the other very popular strategy. I mentioned this earlier when you have tiered caches. So let's look at this for a second. Look at the two boxes up there. Let's assume that those two are the caches you've got in your VM, in your application. Okay, it could be in your web app, let's say. You've got it in your web app. You can't make these caches too big because your web app's running in an app server. An app server's taken up a lot of memory, and your application's taken a lot of memory, and so on and so forth. So those caches can at most be, I don't know, half a gig or something, right? So you can't make them too big. But you want to address a lot of state. Down here in your database, all the way down here, you've got, I don't know, 100 gigs worth of stuff, right? So like that half a gig cache up there is not very good. It's not very useful. I mean, it's useful for some things, but not much, right? So this is where you can introduce another layer into your architecture, a whole extra layer which is dedicated to caching stuff in memory, right? Now here, this second tier down there, doesn't have any app server running. It doesn't have anything else running. Those servers aren't doing anything. You can dedicate all the resources on those servers to the cache. And again, like I said, memory is cheap. You can, you know, stack up that tier with lots of memory, 10 gigs or whatever, and have a lot of stuff cached in memory. Now, this is actually much more efficient than going to the database. So your front end queries its local cache first. If it's not there, the local cache will transparently delegate to the second cache tier. And if it finds it there, it gets it from there before it goes down to the database. So it's much, much faster than making a remote call to the database. Here, it's just one remote call to another in-memory system. Another high availability strategy is buddy replication. Now, this is something that, it's not brand new or anything. We've had this for a couple of years now. But again, this has kind of grown from the community. It's grown from what people have wanted, specifically what the JBoss app server wanted, because they needed to do this stuff with HTTP sessions, because they've got session affinity. They're always going to the same server all the time. So they needed a way where they don't replicate state to everybody in the cluster. That's too expensive. That's much, much too expensive, right? They just want to replicate just to one other guy. They just need one other backup. That's it. So that's what this does. Here, basically, as you can see, node A replicates to node B replicates to node C, so on and so forth. But node A is not replicating to everybody. It means that your memory footprint is smaller. It means that your response times are much, much better. But crucially, it means that you can now scale linearly. You can add more servers to this cluster, and your response times are not going to go down based on the number of servers you have, right? Now, what happens when a server dies? Basically, the system detects it, and as you can see, node B now has node A's state as well as node B's state. It realizes node A has died, I'm his backup. Okay, I'm going to put all that together now and treat all that as my state, and I'm now going to back all that up together with my state. So nothing's actually lost in this system. Nothing's ever lost in this system. And if you have a smart load balancer, it will be able to redirect your requests down to node B instead. If you have a dumb load balancer that goes to, I don't know, node E or node D or whatever, it still works because it'll still be able to find that state in the system and move it around. So all very good, but it doesn't actually prevent you from, doesn't save you from that situation. Right, so I've got like a couple of minutes left, so I'm sort of rushing through this bit here. I'm just going to talk very briefly about benchmarks, and the reason why, like I said, I've got this bit here is because we're on the cusp of a major new release, right? So up until now, the current GA release was 2.2. We are about to release 3.0. 3.0 has MVCC, like I mentioned earlier, the new locking scheme, and it's... much, much faster than 2.2 as a result. It's much more robust and so on and so forth. And it's a very, very efficient in-memory cache now as well. Because traditionally, we've always been known as a very good replicated cache. But in memory, it's too complicated. Why use JBoss cache, right? No, not true anymore. With 3.0, we're actually a very, very efficient standalone in-memory cache as well. EH cache has always kind of been the benchmark, the open source benchmark, of a very, very fast in-memory cache. I mean, they've started doing replication only recently, and they're not very well known for replication, but they're very well known for fast standalone caches. So basically, we've been using this as a benchmark for 3.0 for standalone stuff to make sure we're at least as fast as. We wrote this benchmarking framework to actually benchmark different caching products, both in a cluster and standalone. The EHCache guys have actually helped write parts of this, so we know it's a valid framework and it does work. And that's what the numbers kind of look like. So the big red bar you see there, this chart is for read operations, yeah? This was done over like 8 million transactions, all happening concurrently on 25 threads and so on and so forth, right, on a single machine. The yellow bar over there, that's 3.0. That's 3.0, I think, CR1. And the number doesn't really make that much sense. It's like 6 microseconds, but it's more the relationship that I wanted to show. These two here, that's 2.1, that's 2.2, that's 3.0, and that's EHCache up there. For writing, things look kind of similar. I mean, it's not... as great, because like I said, there's a lot more work happening here in 3.0 when it comes to writing. when you use MVCC, there's a copy on write going on, and the copy on write's a bit more expensive. But as you can see, it's much, much better than traditional locking models, right? Now, in JBoss Cache 2, we use the whole JDK5 read lock, write lock mechanism. EHCache uses synchronized blocks. So you can see the order of magnitude difference in how you actually handle your locking. So that's all well and good for standalone stuff, but what about a distributed benchmark? They're coming soon. We're going to be publishing this over the coming weeks. So 3.0 is going to go GA very soon now, in the next few weeks, and we'll be publishing distributed benchmarks. And so far, they look pretty good as well. So just keep an eye on the blog site. You'll see the numbers come up there soon. Okay, so I've just about finished with 5 minutes for Q&A. After rushing through all that. Now, having seen Ted's talk this morning and how nobody asked any questions, I've decided to take it a step further, and I'm actually offering prizes to people who are actually going to ask questions. It doesn't matter if they're good questions, bad questions, irrelevant questions. Here's a question, what's the prize? Right, so anybody? There you go. Prizes always work, right? Actually, you know what? Let me pass you the mic. I'll do a bit of running, since I got to deliver prizes anyway.
I actually wanted to ask you where you are storing the Lucene index. How it's built? Is it also distributed somehow? How you are synchronized the index, so you are able to query the cache on each node.
Okay, so we actually decouple the way the indexes are generated versus how they are distributed. So basically, the way they're generated, we actually use Hibernate Search. Hibernate Search is a little library that sits on top of Lucene, and it introspects object models. It breaks down object models and creates something that Lucene can deal with, a document that Lucene can deal with. So that's how the indexes are generated, right? How they are replicated, that's up to you. There's the Lucene backend that sits behind the searchable cache. If you configure the Lucene backend to use disk, it'll use disk. If you use the Lucene backend to use Hadoop, a Hadoop file system, it'll use that. I've actually written a JBoss cache plugin for the Lucene directory so that Lucene indexes are stored back in the cache as well and then distributed. I mean, that's just an experimental thing I've been playing around with. That's why I didn't speak about it too much. But, I mean, yeah, that is something that we're doing as well. Sorry, could you see? I want someone to now give you a mic instead.
So it's free for the user where the index is stored.
I'm sorry?
It's user decision where the index is stored.
Exactly.
Okay.
And your prize. Anybody else? Anyone else? Question over here? Sorry, you're going to have to do a lot of work, a lot of running up and down. Why don't you take this with you, actually? Once and for all. A bit more efficient, right? No round trips.
I wanted to ask if the value replication support varying number of the values that will be replicated, like the one node will back up to values.
So do you want the one-word answer or the 10-word answer?
Can be
the one-word answer is yes. The more complex answer is it's yes, and you can also configure, you can also plug in the algorithms used to pick the buddies, which makes it even more interesting. Any more? Anyone on this side? This side is very quiet. Over here? Excuse me. Oh, over there.
As we know, Lucene use query analyzers.
Right.
And what kind of query analyzers we are using in case of JBoss cache?
I'm sorry, using a query analyzer?
Yeah. And, thanks.
Since I'm here.
What is the influence, developer influence to how to configure these query analyzers?
Well, basically, it uses Lucene out of the box. There's no changes. You don't need to use Lucene in any way different than you currently use Lucene, right? The analyzers are exactly the same. The query objects themselves are exactly the same. Nothing changes, literally. The only difference is you give the query object to me, to JBoss Cache, instead of Lucene, and JBoss Cache will do stuff with it. Okay. Anything else?
Hibernate uses a concept of cache providers, which has already built-in implementations for EHCache and Hashtable.
Yeah.
And do you support Hibernate, or do you plan to support such cache providers in Hibernate?
Hibernate is our second biggest use case. So, yes, we support Hibernate. Hibernate ships with JBoss Cache. JBoss AS's JPA implementation is Hibernate, and that uses JBoss Cache, and so on and so forth. So, simple answer again, yes. Anything else?
Oh, over here.
Well, what do you mean by caching policy? Are you talking about expiration and eviction, or are you talking about the way replication works?
About the real implementation of the cache, because you are using JBoss Cache, but there are different strategies in which they may play. So we can decide to increase the amount of available memory for a cache, decrease it dynamically, the same with the permanent storage.
At the moment, no, you can't. I mean, you can change certain things at runtime, but not too many. The reason why is because, for example, if it's stuff like your network stack, that involves a lot of teardown and restart of resources.
It's very difficult, but yeah. I think it's it should be fast.
Yeah, I mean, but like I was saying, some things you can. So things like your eviction policies and stuff like that, that you can actually change at runtime, so you can say, okay, fine, this region can only hold n number of nodes or n number of elements, and then you can dynamically change that to 2n or whatever.
And another thing, we should also be able to mark which data are more important for us than the other one, so this should be replicated the first way.
Right, like a priority queue of sorts. Yeah, no, again, right now, no, you can't do that. But hey, this is open source, man. Well, what I meant to say by that is it's open source, so get online, and if you want to contribute a patch, please do. Happy to welcome that.
I will encourage all my students.
Thank you. All right, so maybe one last question, yeah? Up there. Not because I only have one last hat. Sorry, could you pass that up, please?
Hello, okay. With regards to tools, you said you plan to cache something. What is it exactly? Is it the working memory? Are these rules, rule packages?
It's a working memory.
Okay, the whole working memory?
Yes, the entire working memory state we plan to replicate it across a cluster or a grid so that the entire grid can process this working memory in parallel.
Okay, great, thanks.
Cool, easy answer. Okay, well, I've still got a few more of these, only we don't have any time for more questions, so I'm going to just chuck these around at random and see if my frisbee throwing skills work. There you go. Well, thank you all for turning up. You guys get an extra bonus for sitting in front. I think you guys deserve a little extra there. There you go. I was actually worried about this slot, saying I've got the slot just before lunch. Everyone's going to be hungry and ready to go. And there you go. Sorry, I can't throw that far back. All right. Thank you.